Words and music for spirit and courage. We'll start today with a thought experiment for a dark, dark time. Suppose you're someone who believes that love is more powerful than hate, that our lives have purpose, and that purpose is to help each other, help heal the world. And let's say you believe that an injury to one is an injury to all, that you're someone who knows that the miners don't find the gold, that you're someone who knows that the mine owners don't find the gold, it's the miners who find the gold. And let's say you're someone who believes we owe each other respect and dignity, and that that depends on... And let's say you're someone who believes we owe each other respect, and we codify that respect and dignity in the rule of law and in democratic principles. And then, suppose that the world tells you, nah, you've got all that wrong. Well, I say that's when you have to be who you truly are. I'm Michael Goldberg, here to tell you that I love America. I know it's not exactly the 4th of July or anything, but I want to tell you the root of my love of a country. I owe my life to the brutal crimes committed by the U.S. Cavalry against the indigenous peoples. I never would have been born if my grandparents couldn't have escaped the pogroms and the Tsar's army at the beginning of the last century. And then to come here to what they believed was, and for them and their children proved itself to be, the land of opportunity. How can I be glad of my own life and honor the lives of my grandparents, and at the same time be horrified at the actions of the settlers and the slave owners? How work to restore some justice? I don't know how. All I can do is live inside the contradictions, rededicate what I hold sacred, and in the body politic, I pledge allegiance to the American people and to the republic for which they stand.
This land is your land.
With what ought to be our national anthem. Woody Guthrie wrote it as a sing-along, so even if it's just you in the radio, everybody now lift your voice and stay human.
This land is your land.
couple of weeks ago, I asked my friend Marsh Muirhead, a frequent contributor to this program, if he could write something for me about love of country. Whatever you want, I said, but no politics. Here's Marsh Muirhead.
The question, what does it mean, love of country, to be a patriot? Or a better question, what do I love about this country? First, listen to the music. Bob Dylan and Patsy Cline, Frank Sinatra, Billie Holiday and Johnny Cash, Cole Porter and Leontine Price, George Gershwin and Leonard Bernstein, Ella Fitzgerald, Louis Armstrong, Elvis, Prince, and hundreds of others writing and performing the musical score to our lives every day. Woody Guthrie's song that begins, "This land is your land," reminds us that to love this country is to love the actual land, the country, the landscape, its soil and water and wonders, the Eden that is tropical, fragrant Hawaii, the Arctic wilderness of northern Alaska, the majestic mountains where I've hiked 1,000 miles, the Grand Canyon and Everglades, the deserts of the Southwest, the prairies and coastlines that we share with the citizens of those places, the polar bear and grizzly, the elk and the whales, eagles and the owls, and each other. We are a melting pot of the originals, Native Americans, the rest of us immigrants from elsewhere, all of this represented in our food, some of it truly American, most an amalgamation from elsewhere, poke from Southeast Asia and Hawaii, gumbo from West Africa, barbecue brought to Texas from Spaniards who brought it up from the Caribbean, red beans and rice from Haiti, and here, truly American, chocolate chip cookies, and the peanut butter and jelly sandwich. Peanut butter was first introduced in 1893 at the World's Fair in Chicago, the PB&J 10 years later at a restaurant in Boston. Fry bread was created by Native Americans in the mid-1800s with the government subsidies of flour, oil, and salt. This, after they were pushed onto reservations, away from the many of their centuries-old sources of food, corn, wild rice, nuts and berries, fish, bison, and other meat. Nothing is more American than Hollywood and the movies, and I love them. I try to see all the Oscar nominations every year, and I hold a house party to watch the Academy Awards, which has been held since 1929. I clearly remember seeing Charlton Heston as Moses part the Red Sea in the Ten Commandments with my mother when I was 6. And among 100 others are these, favorites of mine and yours, Casablanca, Star Wars, The Godfather, Saving Private Ryan, Schindler's List, The Wizard of Oz, To Kill a Mockingbird. I love so many American writers, so much so that in midlife, I was almost 40, I went back to school for an English degree, an excuse to embrace so many writers I'd read or wanted to read. Emily Dickinson, Whitman and Frost, Hemingway and Harper Lee, Stephen King, Toni Morrison and Mark Twain, Steinbeck, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Willa Cather, Flannery O'Connor, and Edgar Allan Poe. There is much else that I love about this country or greatly appreciate, Kentucky bourbon and the National Weather Service, public and community radio and television, the fact that 70% of all Nobel Prizes have won by Americans, the air traffic control system, our men on the moon, the Vikings, twins, some of the time, and the Lynx, Steve Martin and David Letterman. We might be very angry about an unjust war, corrupt tax policies favoring the powerful, when treaties are broken, when immigrant parents are separated from their children, when someone tries to suppress the vote, when the science of climate change is ignored. Outrage and protest is a love of country. Love it and fix it. We are best when embracing our shared humanity, our passions and aspirations, understanding that we are one human family. Woody Guthrie sang that this land is made for you and me, but questions that in another verse. In the shadow of the steeple, I saw my people. By the relief office, I seen my people. As they stood there hungry, I stood there asking, is this land made for you and me? It is a cliche. Is this a great country or what? Well, not always. But it is our duty to try and make it so, to be part of the solution and not part of the problem.
Thanks to Bemidji writer Marsh Muirhead. This past week, I turned back to a brilliant piece of writing that has given me a lot of spirit and courage over the years, and always gives me something new to think about, too. It was written by E.B. White, then a staff writer at New Yorker magazine. He explains his occasion to write it in 1943. We received a letter from the Writers' War Board the other day asking for a statement on, quote, the meaning of democracy. It presumably is our duty to comply with such a request, and it's certainly our pleasure. Surely the board knows what democracy is. It is the line that forms on the right. It is the don't in don't shove. It is the hole in the stuffed shirt through which the sawdust slowly trickles. It's the dent in the high hat. Democracy is the recurrent suspicion that more than half of the people are right more than half of the time. It is the feeling of privacy in the voting booths, the feeling of communion in the libraries, the feeling of vitality everywhere. Democracy is a letter to the editor. Democracy is the score at the beginning of the ninth. It is an idea which hasn't been disproved yet, a song the words of which have not gone bad. It's the mustard on the hot dog and the cream in the ration coffee. Democracy is a request from a war board in the middle of a morning, in the middle of a war, wanting to know what democracy is. E.B. White, 81 years ago, true then, still true now, I think. That's up to us. Coming up in this hour, Sonia Merrill talks about becoming a U.S. citizen. James Earl Jones tells us what Abe Lincoln said. And Robert Jevney breaks down the Gettysburg Address. The Indigo Girls, Let It Be Me. Democracy, says E.B. White, is the mustard on the hot dog, the score at the top of the ninth. I'm sure my friend Fred Friedman would agree with him on that. He knows quite a bit about both the ballpark and the democracy. He's been a volunteer sports commentator on KXE for some 40 years, and he worked as long in the federal judicial system. He supervised and helped train generations of public defenders. He spent a lot of time over the years in federal courthouses, which is where, sometimes, there's a citizenship swearing-in ceremony at which new American citizens recite the Oath of Allegiance. Fred told me he attends these ceremonies whenever he can.
I've done it in Chicago, in Indiana, in the Twin Cities, and in Duluth. And I consider it moving to be there. And I've seen different approaches by different federal judges swearing people in. And sometimes I know the folks there, but not every time. So I consider it an honor to be there. Honored to be a citizen, and I don't know about you, but all four of my grandparents came from the old country, and they were all sworn in, right, at various places in the late 1890s. So I think it's a big deal, and every time I've done it, I'm glad I did, and I look forward to doing it again. I think it's a special big deal. I also go out of my way to research questions on the citizenship exam, because I believe that there are all kinds of American high school and graduate school and college kids that could not answer them. Not because they're difficult or unfair or tricky, just because we're not doing a very good job of teaching social studies, and definitely not as good a job as we did once upon a time. That's just my opinion. How about this? What amendment to the Bill of Rights of the Constitution protects you against unreasonable searches and seizures? One amendment provides all people with the right to counsel. I want to regard them as basic, you know what I mean? They're important questions. Everybody should do it. I mean, everybody, teachers ought to take a class there, sit in the back. I mean, they're wide open to the public. And like I say, there's so much sadness and tragedy, whether it's money or liberty, that go on in courthouses, right? It's nice to see something where everybody comes out feeling really good about it. We're all immigrants. No offense to anybody, but we all come from immigrant people, right? Whether it's Africa or Europe or, you know, or Asia, you know, we all come from somewhere.
Fred Friedman. Up next, Sonia Merrill of Grand Rapids tells us her story of citizenship.
Unless you've moved from country to country, or you might not think about your citizenship, right? But for somebody like me, citizenship has been sort of a journey and a very distinct part of my lifetime and identity. I think psychologically too, or it has been sort of a journey of figuring out belonging and responsibility. I had been an exchange student in this country as a teenager, a regular exchange student program in a high school out in the sticks of Wyoming, of all places. And I met a cowboy. And I decided to come back to the United States because of that. So this is the story of sort of traveling through life and trying to find a place, belonging, that all of a sudden becomes a big thing when I want to be with this other person. And it starts with applying for a visa, and then it becomes application for a work permit. And then after we got engaged, because I stayed, it becomes an application to become, at the time it was called, a resident alien. And always figured that at some point, it's a very personal thing to say, okay, I belong so much now to a new culture that I want to commit so full as to become a citizen. And each country has reciprocal citizenship agreements with a variety of countries. And some countries, like Denmark, at the time, for the longest time, did not allow a dual citizenship status, i.e. Danes are very, very proud. And if I were to become a resident of another country, I would have to renounce my status as a Dane, which, you know, when you think about nationality, which is a completely different status or identity, that would seem impossible for me to renounce. I just couldn't. It's part of my cellular ancestral structure. It just wouldn't have been possible for me to do that. It would have been a betrayal of, you know, myself and my family all the way. But those rules changed in 2015, and it allowed me to think differently about a citizenship status because of that. And also, our country was changing so significantly from what I had experienced the United States as my second country. It was changing so significantly in 2015, culturally, politically, socially, that I felt like the one thing that I wasn't able to do by having chosen not to become a U.S. citizen was to participate fully in the democratic process. I mean, everything else about my status and about my life was similar to any other American. Nobody looking at me would ever know that I was an immigrant, which is a whole different story, as a white immigrant story is so different from the immigrant story of a brown or black or Asian person. So here we are in 2015, and I finally have a different landscape in front of me where the decision could be made that would not adversely affect my Danish citizenship status. So I thought, well, let's go for it. I did want to participate. I had thought about running for city council. I had helped friends of mine, notably the current mayor, run for city council. And I knew that any city position or county position where I wanted to have local influence, if I wanted to get engaged, I could only do that if I was an eligible voter, and that I wasn't. So I thought, okay, it's time to become fully American. And later in 2015, toward the end of 2015, my application was approved. And strangely, as I'm sitting here talking about it, it was actually a pretty momentous decision, right? Because I had always felt in my heart, always felt fully Danish, and I still am. And also had wrestled with, well, who are you when you are not just one nationality, but two? And gaining citizenship was a way of cementing sort of my dual belonging to cultures, to peoples, and now today to families. So I'd get goosebumps just sitting here telling this story. Once my application was approved, my first call was to my parents, who prior to our living in South Africa, had, both of them had immigrated to the United States in the early 60s, independent of one another as Danes, seeking work, then later had met San Francisco and married in Portland. And so their joy of seeing me reconnecting and committing to a country that united them was sort of an extra beautiful part of our family story. And there was no doubt that even though they were aging, and they still, my dad is now nearing his late 80s, but at the time, you know, still able to travel, there was no doubt that they wanted to show up in person for this citizenship ceremony. So my colleagues showed up, there were neighbors, friends, and it ended up being a very special ceremony. I think there were maybe a dozen and a half approved citizenship seekers from all countries. I remember it as being just, I have the image of like an unfolding of a fan of just nationalities and families with their own flags and American flags. And there were attorneys who work within the federal courthouse, most notably somebody who you also know from KHC Radio, who used to be a public defender in Duluth, Fred Friedman, who I had met, you know, who showed to the ceremony. Because within the ecosystem of the federal courthouse system, there are not that many occasions to show up in a courtroom that are truly celebratory. And, you know, family reunions or adoptions, reunification of family members or adoption of family members and citizenship ceremony, one of the few occasions that are really happy and celebratory in this environment. And that was very evident. It can just bring tears to my eyes how just people who are interested in the positive nature of this welcoming of new citizens showed up. My parents will never forget this. Fred Friedman is of Jewish heritage and took the opportunity while my Danish parents were there to thank them for what the Danes did for the Jewish people during World War II, which was an added complete surprise and sort of a tender moment for my parents, who both of them were alive during World War II and whose parents were both were part of the underground resistance in Denmark during the German occupation. So just another thread of what happens in a ceremony like this when a variety of people come together. So the whole thing was, the whole ceremony was, there was a reverence and a solemnity, I think it's called, about it. And each person is called up and there's a certificate and there's an American flag and a Danish flag and you know, family members. And then at the end, our then President Obama came on a video and welcomed us as new citizens to the United States. And it could not have been more special. And so I think for those of us who choose citizenship and go through a ceremony like this, inevitably end up taking our citizenship and our rights, and I would say especially our responsibilities. Citizenship, you know, is a mixture of rights and responsibilities. And I think my take on it is that those who I know who have chosen to become citizens take those responsibilities quite seriously. As far as, you know, exercising voting rights and exercising our free right to participate in governance of organizations or cities or counties or at the state level. We participate in councils or in nonprofit organizational leadership and leadership at every level because I should speak for myself. I certainly do not take this for granted.
Thanks to Sonia Merrill. She's well known in the area for her engagement and leadership on all kinds of things. And if you know her, you know she means every word she said. tuned to a uniquely American kind of broadcast service. Most countries have radio and television that's owned by the government, and in the democracies, they also have privately owned commercial broadcasters. But that's not how we do things here. E.B. White says, democracy is the feeling of communion in the libraries, the feeling of vitality everywhere. Community and opportunity. Public broadcasting in America is that unique combination of private initiative and government support that characterizes so much of American civic life. For KAXE, that means local control, local responsibility for, among other things, raising enough local money to keep it going, and state and federal financial support and oversight. The Federal Communications Commission gives us permission to broadcast at our various frequencies, a license that has to be renewed periodically or else we're off the air. But we don't need anyone's permission to stream at kaxe.org and to post our many local features there, stories featuring the voices of folks who live in the communities we serve. That's something else I love about America, plus the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, part of the legacy funds created by Minnesota voters in a constitutional amendment, provides additional support for this program of story and song. So yes, thank you. Here's the Brothers and Sisters with The Gospel According to Bob Dylan. I recently attended a wonderful concert of Music of the Americas from the Itasca Symphony Orchestra in Grand Rapids. The concert included a piece by Aaron Copland that I had never heard. We'll hear an excerpt from it coming up. The Aaron Copland piece reminded me of part of E.B. White's definition of democracy, that it's the don't in don't shove. Democracy is the muscle backing up our freedoms, especially our freedom to say no. To me, the don't in don't shove means our obligation as citizens is not in what we think or what we say, it's in what we do. Although Aaron Copland today is celebrated as the most American of symphonic composers, he was a victim of the Red Scare in the 1950s. In April of 1949, Life magazine, by far the most popular magazine in the country, ran a cover story listing 50 Americans described as, quote, communist dupes and soft-headed do-gooders. The list included Copland and also Arthur Miller, Charlie Chaplin, Albert Einstein, Leonard Bernstein, and others who were leaders in their fields, whose political beliefs were cynically being used to scare Americans about insidious communists everywhere, the enemy within. Hundreds and hundreds of lives were ruined. Civil servants, scientists, writers, actors, university professors, all blacklisted and shoved out of public life. When Pete Seeger was hauled in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee, he refused to plead the Fifth Amendment, a frequently used strategy from many of those who refused to cooperate, refused to name names for the committee. They pleaded the Fifth. Instead, Seeger pleaded the First, explaining, "The Fifth Amendment means I have a right not to answer your questions. The First Amendment means you have no right to ask me those questions." He was slapped with contempt of Congress and couldn't get work for years. In Copland's case, the State Department even revoked his passport, and orchestras around the country refused to perform his works. And that's the thing that most haunts me about the Red Scare. The artistic directors of the nation's leading symphonies, university presidents, executives in the entertainment and other industries, people who, I have to believe, knew it was wrong. They were quickly and thoroughly cowed into obedience. They shrugged their shoulders, abandoned the don't in don't shove. That's how easy it is, I guess, to walk away from defending our freedoms. This piece by Copland was scheduled to be performed at Dwight D. Eisenhower's 1953 presidential inauguration until anti-communists in the Senate forced the inauguration committee to back off. The committee's explanation? We don't want to do anything that would bring criticism. Think about that for a minute, and then imagine applying that rule to your own life, and then slap yourself awake if you ever start to think that way. Here's an excerpt from Copland's Portrait of Lincoln, featuring James Earl Jones.
Fellow citizens, we cannot escape history. That is what he said. That is what Abraham Lincoln said. Fellow citizens, we cannot escape history. We of this Congress and this administration will be remembered in spite of ourselves. No personal significance or insignificance can spare one or another of us. The fiery trial through which we pass will light us down in honor or dishonor to the latest generation. We, even we here, hold the power and bear the responsibility. He was born in Kentucky, raised in Indiana, and lived in Illinois. And this is what he said. This is what Abe Lincoln said. The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present. The occasion is piled high with difficulty, and we must rise with the occasion. As our case is new, so we must think anew and act anew. We must disenthrall ourselves, and then we shall save our country. When standing erect, he was 6 feet 4 inches tall. And this is what he said. He said, "It is the eternal struggle between two principles, right and wrong, throughout the world. It is the same spirit that says, you toil and work and earn bread, and I'll eat it, no matter in what shape it comes, whether from the mouth of a king who seeks to bestride the people of his own nation and live by the fruit of their labor, or from one race of men as an apology for enslaving another race. It is the same tyrannical principle."
Aaron Copland. Up next, something from Northern Minnesota poet Robert Jevney. He described this piece to me as kind of an experiment and expressed some real doubt as to its suitability for broadcast, but I think it breathes new life into old words, breaks down what's been built up, and provocatively captures the stuttering progress of the American experiment. Robert Jevney with "Shall Long Endure."
I memorized this when I was a kid. Please forgive me if I don't have it quite right. 4 score and 7... Four score and seven years ago, our forefathers brought forth upon this a new nation, conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. We are now engaged in a great civil war, testing whether this nation or any other nation shall shall so endure.
Thanks to Robert Jevney. While we're in the 1800s, we'll continue with the words of Harriet Tubman as set to music by Cynthia Erivo.
I've been walking with my face turned to the sun. Weight on my shoulders, a bullet in my gun. Oh, I got eyes in the back of my head, just in case I have to run. I do what I can when I can, while I can for my people. While the clouds roll back and the stars fill the night, that's when I'm gonna stand up, take my people with me. Together we are going to a brand new home, far across the river. Can you hear freedom calling, calling me to answer? Gonna keep on keeping on, I can feel it. And I fight with the strength that I got until I die. So I'm gonna stand up, take my people with me. Together we are going to a brand new home, far across the river. Can you hear freedom calling, calling me to answer? Gonna keep on keeping.
Stand Up, written for the film Harriet, about Harriet Tubman. I'm Michael Goldberg. Thanks for joining me during this hour. I'll be back for another hour of Story and Song, this time next week. Thanks, too, to today's contributors, Robert Jevney, Sonia Merrill, Fred Friedman, and Marshall Muirhead. We'll end this hour with yet another American anthem, this one only written in 2017. Remember that year? By David Mallet, Celebration.
Sometimes you just don't feel like trying. Too many politicians lying. Too many hungry babies crying. Too many random bullets flying. Too much time spent in struggle. Too many little kids in trouble. Too many cities gone to rubble. Too many people talking double. This can't be our destination. This could be better nation. Time to set the big horse racing. We can change the situation. Trains are leaving from the station. Need a brand new generation. This could be a celebration now. Situation's changing fast. Too much plastic, too much trash. Too many smokestacks spewing ash. Too many people with no cash. Too much waste and not enough water. Too many abandoned sons and daughters. Too many lost and hopeless fields. Too many low-down shady dealings. This can't be our destination. This could be better nation. Time to set the course racing. Need a brand new generation. Things are leaving from the station. We are getting no reservation. This could be celebration now. Now.
All the time I hear this roaring, baby stealing iron ore, and people shouting all so short, and their side is the right side for it. I see a man in floors and stores, very tired and poor all the time, folks. They're buried in the wild because they're all so poor. It's becoming natural the way we need things without a reason. Beam to green, the weeds go from the roots. We're all running from the truth. We choose to fight instead of prove ourselves. We love it all upon the shelf. Divide the nature, free to send us anything.
This can't be our destination. This could be better nation. Time to set the big horse racing. Need a brand new generation. Time to change the conversation. Trains are leaving from the station. This could be celebration now. Now. Too many people looking down. Too many closed up factory towns. Too much high-priced propaganda. Too much sadness in this land. The dreams that once could all come true. Now it's down to me and you. Tell me what you gonna do. Tell me what you gonna do. Now this could be our destination. This could be our nation. Time is set to make it more fresh. Need a brand new generation. Dreams are leaving from the station.
Good morning. This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids. 90.